With 8 collections of essays, 2 novels, one of which took him nearly 30 years to write, and numerous works of criticism, William Gass's love of language is self-evident. In his most recent book of essays, Life Sentences, Literary Judgments and Accounts, he writes on a range of topics, from a recollection of his younger self in grammar school to considerations of his favorite writers to his thoughts on style and form. The book is published by Knopp, and I'm very pleased to welcome William Gass to our show today. Hello.
Well, it's very nice to be here.
You open Life Sentences with The Literary Miracle, your acceptance speech for the Truman Capote Award for Literary Criticism in 2007, and in it you state, "What works of art testify to is the presence in this world of consciousness." Is a writer's consciousness different from the consciousness of the rest of us?
Well, a writer's consciousness is different from even he or she as people, because it's constructed. It isn't the kind of consciousness that we have of events just passing by. We pick them up and see or hear about them, feel about them in a certain way. It's more like Thoreau sitting on a little canoe out in the middle of Walden Pond, and he has some experiences, but then when he goes to write about them, he's no longer the person sitting out there on the pond. He's someone putting together that experience in a way that suits him.
But also will raise the awareness of the reader.
Oh, yes. The reader will be in the presence now of this constructed experience. And it will be a lot like listening to Bach so completely that you're just the music.
Do you consider your readers when you're writing?
No. You can't consider anybody, not even yourself. You only have to consider what the text is doing. The text tells you what to write, what to ways to move.
Now, are you saying that a writer isn't born a writer, that a writer becomes one gradually as he or she figures these things out?
Well, you may be born with certain talents, but lots of people are. It's the other part that counts, and that's long, painful, repetitious.
And you talk about how easily metaphors come to you. There's something that you're a bit embarrassed about. That's something that doesn't happen with everybody.
No, that's right. But that could be something that comes with and goes into conversations with friends and never appears on paper and never gets anywhere unless you do something with it.
Now, why do you feel that metaphors are a problem? You describe creating them as being unstoppable, as natural as carp rising to a dimple of bread.
Yes, well, the whole worrisome part of that is you are making this florid language is not popular. And it makes people think he's only thinking about himself. He's not thinking about the problem or how the reader's going to react to it.
Sometimes it sounds like showing off, but
yeah,
a great
up.
Metaphor really can be revelatory.
Oh, yes, yes. I consistently hunt for it.
The great ones.
Yeah, the great ones.
And cross out the other ones. But you say that it is a problem. You also list preaching as a bad habit.
Yes, you have to slide in. You have to worry about sliding into the solemn teacher role again and also, you're full of avoidance, I think, of ideologies of all kinds.
Do you see these bad habits as referring to your own writing or to writing in general?
Well, it's a temptation of all writing, I think, but it's a stage, a pulpit, and so the temptation to preach is very great.
Well, you can preach without sounding like you're preaching, too.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But for me, I do slide, as my opponents would say, into rant.
What about good habits? Are there some that you're particularly proud of?
Well, I take as good a care of the text as I can. I'm not sloppy. I do take 30 years to write a book.
But that was an exception for you. Do you write that slowly?
Generally? I write that not that slowly, but almost every book that I've written is at least 10 years to maybe 15 years old.
Although this book is a collection of essays, so we excuse the 10 years because one was published 10 years ago, one was published 9 years ago.
That's right.
You do play with form, and there's essay, Kafka, Half a Man, Half a Metaphor, where you seem to be getting into Kafka's mind.
Well, that's what the idea of writing another essay on Kafka. Everybody has written on Kafka. So I want to write, justify writing about Kafka. And so I broke him down into three people and then had the piece speak for three people. Certainly not for me, but for his life as a person in a family, as a insurance man, and then as an artist.
Well, when we write biography, don't we have to get into the mind of our subject if we're going to do it well? In some cases, that can be rough because not everybody is admirable.
Yes. Oh, if you're writing biography, yes.
Well, how do you get into the mind of somebody like Henry James, who only wrote about the mind?
Well, you go over the sentences and you analyze them, you take them apart, you balance them. I spent a lot of time in this book on that subject.
My guest is William H. Gass, whose latest book is a collection of essays under the overall title Life Sentences. It is published by Knopf. Your writing has a musicality to it. Do you read your sentences aloud as you're writing?
Yes. I do, not so badly perhaps as Rilke did, who frightened the help by stomping around and almost yelling.
But he was also yelling in German. That scares me.
Yes, indeed, that would. But I do over and over again until it sounds right.
Do you think that all writing should be read aloud easily? There are some writers who don't lend themselves to
that. Yes. But when you say all writing, no, of course not. There's a lot of writing in science, for example. But if you're trying to work out artistic, then you're dealing with the spoken word and not just the written word, the printed word. The spoken word's what we began with. It's the most loaded. If you don't write well to the ear, you're not writing well.
But do you want it to sound natural the way it would be spoken, or is there still some other thing that's more literary?
Sometimes you do, and sometimes you want it to be operatic, sometimes grandiose, but you want it to fit the song.
You spent much of your life as a professor of philosophy, and you often refer to writers like Matthew Arnold and Walter Pater. Why are they important to you?
Well, they write well. You learn from the writing, even if you're no longer persuaded of the ideas. This is one of the things that's remarkable about someone like Plato, who was a beautiful writer, even if you didn't agree with the thing. And to be lifted up in a system of thought which is not your own, but then you now understand what was going on from, in the inside.
Didn't Plato present his writings as the thoughts of Socrates, even though they were really Plato's?
Yes,
Is that part of the fun of reading him?
Yes, and as he got older, he dropped that. Finally, at the end, poor Socrates is no longer present. At first, I think it was a tribute to Socrates, but then as time went on, he he abandoned his...
Well, but Socrates was dead teacher. By then, and he wasn't around to defend himself. No, I wouldn't have said that in a million years. Some of the people you admire, like Arnold and Pater, are considered to be aesthetes. How does aestheticism influence your own writing?
Well, that is a curse word that is dropped on you by people who have other messages.
But you use the word Baroque. That could be seen as a curse word, too, in some people's mouths.
Yes, indeed. And I'm writing a book on Baroque prose right now, and I'm aware of that problem.
Does the Baroque style ever obscure the idea that you're writing about?
It is the idea.
So, to some degree, you're saying that words just come down to their own beauty?
Well, not a word, but in
the
right complex, yes. It's James said it, a book that is well written is a good book. And a book is bad written is bad book. And that's that. And so it's the writing that counts.
But there are books that tell wonderful stories or have great ideas in them that are not written all that well. And then there are other books that can be really boring that are written gorgeously.
Yes, but the many books are for entertainment. On my view, art isn't entertainment.
Is the Baroque style as well received today as it was 30 years ago?
No, I don't. I think it isn't well received at all. And that's one reason I want to work on it.
In an interview you gave in the 1970s in the Paris Review, you revealed that you decided to change your handwriting early in your career. I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, I was trying to get away from everything that was behind me in my life, I think.
Did it affect the way you wrote?
Oh, yes, because it made me write more slowly. I wrote by hand. I had time to think about it. But over a span of a number of years, I realized it was just an affectation and dropped it. I don't write that way anymore.
Have you moved on to, well, I assume typewriters are now computers?
Yeah, I write on the computer now.
Do you feel at 87 that you've been able to work most of the problems you've had with writing out for yourself?
Oh, no, it's harder than ever. And every day is a day that shows you've learned nothing and you're an imbecile and you might as well quit.
You write about your admiration for writers like Henry James and Gertrude Stein. Both very great stylists. Is that what you admire most about them?
Yeah. It's hard to admire a lot of writers because they are not very nice people. But then they write beautifully and nuanced things. And that's what I meant by your first question. Mm-hmm. They, as writers on the page, are great people. And as people in the world, may not be so much. I'd rather have lunch with Colette.
But you prefer to read Stein, although Stein right now is, and Henry James are not as read as they were in the past. I guess Henry James more than Gertrude Stein. And I wonder why, because, for example, Three Lives is great writing and influenced so many people, and yet whenever I ask people if they've read it, they say all they know about Gertrude Stein is A Rose is a Rose, or perhaps they know that she collected Picassos and Matisse's.
Yeah, well, they're being entombed.
By the way, there's a show opening up at the Metropolitan
That's
Museum right now.
And there will be
art collection.
Yes, and I suspect it'll be a big audience for it, too.
Are there any living novelists you admire?
Oh, a great number. But I'm not going to mention them because if I mention one, I should mention 100.
Well, in your essay, Slices of Life in a Library, you say that you own nearly 20,000 books.
That's right.
I can't imagine that you've read every one of them.
Absolutely not, but I know where they are in my library.
William Gass will be speaking and reading from this new collection that we've been talking about, Life Sentences, Literary Judgments and Accounts, tonight at 6:30 at the New School's Kaplan Hall. That's at 66 West 12th Street. And the book is published by Knopf. You say that the next book is going to be about?
Oh, well, the next book is a novel called Middle Sea.
And how long have you been working on it?
About a decade.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Does it sound anything like what you started with?
No. Never do. I never know where I'm going. I'm always surprised at where I arrive.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure.